the origin of life. Despite the conjectures of Descartes and Lemaître, the phenomenon of life seemed for a long time to deny the dispiriting ramifications of Newtonian determinism and reductionism. The incredible order and complexity of life seemed incompatible with the simple deterministic laws of physics. From whence this complexity? The processes of biology are so finely coordinated, so tightly coupled, that it seemed in the 17th century, and still seems to many to this day, that life must be designed and orchestrated by some superior outside intelligence. Furthermore, the growth and spontaneous movement of living beings does not in any obvious way reflect simple mechanical laws like the conservation of momentum. We do not behave as mere masses subject to forces, but initiate action on our own. Intuition tells us that this animation, this spontaneous movement and growth is a key feature of life. Thales recognized as much in the 7th century BCE when he said, "The lodestone has life or soul, as it is able to move iron," close quote. As did Aristotle in associating life with the movement, the soul creates movement. As recently as the 19th century, the vitalists articulated the same intuition that only some élan vital could produce life's spontaneity in a universe of dead matter. To make the Newtonian worldview work, some explanation was necessary of how purposeful, animated, complex life forms could emerge from dead chemicals. The original mechanical conception of life, heart as pump, lungs as bellows, was spectacularly unsuccessful in explaining much more than the circulation of the blood, and actually not even that. It was only in the 19th century, with the work of Mendel and Darwin, that there was any real progress reconciling the simplicity of physics and chemistry with the seeming animation and purpose of nature. By the end of the 20th century, the sciences of molecular biology and genetics purported to provide, if not a solution, at least the outline of a solution to all the fundamental mysteries of life, from its origin, to its evolution, to its present behavior. Not coincidentally, the grand synthesis of Darwinian evolution and Mendelian genetics solved these problems in a way that reinforced the defining ideologies of our civilization, the discrete and separate self, the program to control the world, the primacy of competition as an agent of progress, and the destiny of humankind to eventually transcend nature through technology. At present, the dominant understanding of change in nature is neo-Darwinism, which Lynn Margulis has summarized as an attempt to reconcile Mendelian genetics, which says that organisms do not change with time, with Darwinism, which claims they do. In Mendelian genetics, variation within a species comes only from the recombination of existing DNA, which denies the possibility of genuinely new traits ever emerging. However, overwhelming evidence from paleontology, embryology, genetics, and other fields makes it clear that life indeed evolves over time, and that genuinely new features arise repeatedly across the eons. Neo-Darwinism ascribes the source of this change to random mutation, and its direction to natural selection, the competition for resources to survive and reproduce. Biological evolution is supposed to happen through a gradual accumulation of random point mutations, frame shift errors, accidental deletions and insertions, and other chance alterations to DNA, which are then tried out, expressed in actual organisms in various combinations. Most mutations are either deadly or harmless, but occasionally one of them will create some new characteristic which confers a competitive advantage, enabling the new organism and its descendants to dominate the old in its ecological niche, or to occupy a new niche altogether. Over time, the accumulation of these new characteristics comes to define a new species. The traditional view of biology is that the self is the expression of the genes, which comprise the blueprint for morphology and the underlying determinant of behavior. Only in humans, it is thought, does the countervailing determinant of culture sometimes override or at least modify genetic programming? This is an old idea in new garb. In an earlier age, it was not genetic programming, but rather our bestial nature, original sin, or the temptations of the flesh. Either way, the conclusion is the same, that we are, with the rise of culture, transcending nature. We are transcending our biology and rising to a new estate, a uniquely human realm. Aside from the human exception, it is thought, all living beings follow their genetic program, acting on the environment according to the gene's instructions, mediated through the machinery of proteins and their products. To engineer an organism, then, is really just a matter of engineering its genes, whose properties are fundamentally isolable from the environment. The conception of the genes as the blueprint and program for the organism therefore abets the program of control as well as identifying them as the kernel of the biological self. The blueprint and program genetic paradigm dovetails nicely with Cartesian objectivity. The genes are separate from the environment, which they try to manipulate, and themselves only affected by the environment accidentally through random mutation. This view parallels the view of man separate from nature, subject to its random whims perhaps, but nonetheless the master, the conscious manipulator of unconscious matter. It also parallels the Cartesian conception of the soul, residing at the body's control center and supervising its actions. Ironically enough, it parallels as well the conventional Christian conception of God, running nature from a separate vantage point outside nature. Orthodox genetics fits in very well with all our culture's assumptions about self and world. No wonder there has been such resistance to alternative understandings of the genes that see them as instruments of environmental purpose and not the kernel of autonomous, discrete biological selfhood. In Chapter 6, we will examine some of these alternatives, from those of Jean-Baptiste Lamarck to present-day iconoclasts like Bruce Lipton. When the blueprint and program model of the gene falls, much else will fall with it. A good way to see the cultural ramifications of modern biology is to start with its account of the origin of life and its answers to the eternal human questions of where did we come from, why are we here, and where are we going? Evolutionary biology has given us the outlines of a story of the origin of life, our creation myth. Like all creation myths, it encodes deep-seated cultural values as well as our sense of ourselves as a people. I will introduce it with an eye for the cultural assumptions and biases it implies. In believing this, I will ask, what do we necessarily believe about ourselves? Why are we here? What is the purpose of life? Where are we going? Not only are the answers encoded within the creation story that we choose to believe in, they predispose us toward that creation story. Richard Dawkins' 1990 book, The Selfish Gene, lucidly presents the prevailing view of biogenesis, conceived 100 years ago by Oparin and Haldane. Like the neo-Darwinian theory of evolution, it hinges on two key features, random mutation and natural selection. The story starts with a prebiotic soup of the organic molecules that are the building blocks of life. The crucial event is the appearance by chance of a complex molecule with a very special property of catalyzing the formation of a new copy of itself. Admittedly, the probability of this happening randomly is exceedingly low, but it only had to happen once. Because as soon as such a molecule existed, it began creating copies of itself. Dawkins calls this molecule a replicator, the precursor to the first gene. Soon the ocean was full of such replicators. Not all of them were the same, though, because random copying errors created a number of variants. Some of them varied in ways that rendered them unable to create copies of themselves. Such species quickly disappeared. Other variants were more stable or more fecund. They replicated faster, so they became more common in the soup. At some point, the chemical building blocks became scarce, and some replicator variants could no longer reproduce so well. Other variants did much better, for instance, those that were able to cannibalize other replicators and use their parts. Conditions changed, and as they changed, some random variants did better than others. At some point, again through random copying errors, mutations, some replicators emerged with new properties, protective protein coats, for instance, and eventually protein-based machinery to exercise homeostasis within a lipid membrane. Innumerable failures accompanied each evolutionary jump to a higher level of complexity. For each mutation that enjoyed an advantage in survival and replication, there were thousands that were doomed to extinction. A sponsoring assumption in the selfish gene biogenesis story is that there is a clear demarcation between organism and environment. There are the replicators, which are distinct from one another, and there is the substrate. The key event in the origin of life is the appearance of a molecule, presumably a strand of RNA or something like it, that can replicate itself. The separate individual is seen as primary. How naturally this fits in with the beliefs of our own culture that human beings are separate from nature and that each of us has a distinct, separate existence, independent of other human beings. How naturally it accords with the attitude that nature is a collection of resources for us to use to our best advantage. Replicator and substrate, humanity and natural resources, self and environment. The very word environment assumes the viability of the inside-outside distinction and the self-non-self distinction. So deeply are these assumptions ingrained that only with difficulty can we even recognize them as assumptions and not objective facts about reality. We can hardly conceive of an origin of life that does not start with an original living creature, discrete and separate from its environment, because that is how we conceive an organism, a being. Yet other cultures recognized a more fluid identity in which the defining unit was the family, the tribe, the village, the forest. The very meaning of I is culturally determined. The shaman Martin Prechtel speaks of a culture in which a person beseeching a medicine man to cure his ailing wife says not, "My wife is sick," but rather, "My family is sick." The sickness is as much his own as his wife's. Or if a few individuals in the village are sick, he might say, "My village is sick." Even if a Western doctor might judge him a magnificent specimen of bodily health, he would not agree with the statement, "I am healthy," because to him, I means something different than it does to us. Its boundaries are more fluid. For him to say, "I am healthy, but my family, village, forest, or world is sick," would be as absurd as to say, "I am healthy, but my liver, kidneys, and heart are sick." Someone immersed in such a culture might not see the appearance of a replicator as the key event in biogenesis at all. This is not merely an enlightened understanding that no person can be truly healthy if his family, village, or ecosystem is not healthy. It is a broader definition of self that includes family, village, and ecosystem. It is an understanding written into such spiritual teachings as the Hermetic principle, as above, so below. The Taoist concept of an internal universe embodying all the relationships that exist externally, and the Buddhist teachings of karma, that anything you do to the world, you do to yourself, and the unreality of the self. It is very difficult for us moderns to understand the non-dualistic teachings of ancient religions, including Christianity, except through the lens of dualism. Thus, karma is misunderstood as an outside universe somehow exacting revenge for misdeeds and rewarding good deeds. Animism is misunderstood as all things possessing a separate substance, spirit. As above, so below is misunderstood to imply an independently existing line of demarcation, the self, between the two independent realms. Christianity is misunderstood to posit a God fundamentally separate from this life and this earth. These misunderstandings all stem from our conception of the self. Similarly, our conception of the self predisposes us toward, and then draws further support from, the neo-Darwinian story of biogenesis and evolution, and blinds us to competing tales of potentially greater explanatory power. Blind also are we to evidence for them in nature, which we either ignore, dismiss as an interesting curiosity or exception, or awkwardly attempt to explain away in terms of competition and survival. Nonetheless, scientifically cogent theories of biogenesis that do not start with a separate and discrete replicator do exist. In these, ecosystem and not organism is primary, or life is a fundamental property of the universe. I explore such theories in Chapter 6. Predictably, they will have consequences far beyond biology, since they suggest a very different concept of what a self is. Another key feature of neo-Darwinian biogenesis and evolution is the absence of purpose or intention. No replicator planned on developing a protein coat or any other feature. Each new mutation happened by chance and survived only because this new configuration was better able to survive and replicate. Evolution is the random, undirected exploration of the space of possible replicating molecules. All the life forms we see today in their bewildering complexity are nothing more than the devices by which these replicators, now genes, survive and reproduce themselves. Accordingly, the fundamental explanation for the behavior of living beings, including humans, is that genes program such behavior because it confers a competitive advantage on the organism, enabling it to better survive and pass on those genes. So in observing animal behavior, the Darwinian biologist asks, what competitive advantage does such behavior serve? And looks for an explanation in those terms. It is assumed that the genes essentially program the morphology and behavior of living beings. A mutant gene might program a different behavior, which may or may not aid the chances of reproduction. Those that do survive and those that don't go extinct. Analogous thinking underlies the anthropological and paleontological study of human beings. Again, the scientist asks, what competitive advantage does such behavior serve? Or, how does this adaptation, biological or technological, contribute to survival? Implicit in Darwin is the assumption that competition and survival are the proper terms by which to understand the living world. Now, most people I know don't behave like ruthless maximizers of their genetic self-interest. Does that mean that, thank goodness, culture has sufficiently conditioned us into moral, ethical, socially responsible beings? Or is it the other way around? Is it instead that our true nature is love, wholeness, and creativity, and that culture drills into us a survival anxiety that thwarts the expression of our true nature? Do you sometimes truly desire to do the right thing? To dedicate yourself to serving other people? To do good work but feel you cannot afford to? This is an important question. Paralleling the broader technological conquest of nature, the contemporary understanding of genetics motivates a war against human nature. Because it is based on random mutation, there is no directedness, no purpose to evolution. There is therefore at bottom no purpose to human existence either, except for that programmed into us by our genes. To put it in the simplest terms, the purpose of life is to survive and reproduce. That is, as Dawkins puts it, the ultimate rationale for our existence. So that we do not underestimate the ramifications of that statement, let's examine what the ultimate rationale for love might be. The genes program a mother to love her offspring because the behavior that comprises love helps the offspring survive to adulthood and pass on those same genes to the next generation. Our genes code for the production of certain proteins, which are the construction materials for the glandular and neurological machinery that is in turn the production site for for the hormones and neurotransmitters that we experience as love. Romantic love also contributes to the replication of our genes in the most obvious way, and through similar mechanisms. These confer such a huge advantage in survival and replication of our genes that it is worth having them, even if they get misapplied sometimes, directed at other people's children, for instance, or at humanity in general, or life in general. Forget all sentimental, religious, or spiritual theories about love. Its real essence is simply a way to maximize the survival of your genes. This is natural selection, the struggle to survive. Darwinism sees the world of life as essentially a vast competition for survival, in which the life forms that survive are those that outcompete the others for scarce resources. How like the society of Darwin's time. In the age of laissez-faire economics, described as a dog-eat-dog world, the theory of evolution by natural selection must have seemed intuitively obvious. And not only is life a competition, but competition is good, the engine of progress. Not just biological progress, evolution, but technological and economic progress as well. This view helps motivate the technological program because it enables us to dominate, that is, outcompete, the rest of nature. It is explicit in liberal economic theory, whose models draw out positive consequences of competition. The parallel in economic discourse to Darwinian evolution is nearly exact. The fittest forms survive, the less fit go extinct, and the competitive environment pushes all of them to continually improve through efficiency and innovation. Without competition, what would push firms to ever improve on last year's model? Images of the dinosaur firms of the old Soviet Union come to mind. In fact, the competition that we see as a driving force of life and evolution is very much a projection of our own cultural beliefs. Just as we project our own anxiety onto primitive peoples, so also do we project the relentless competitiveness of modern human life onto nature. Competition is an important part of nature, of course, but I do not believe that it is the prime mover, the defining feature, nor the engine of progress. In Chapter 6, I will lay out another paradigm based on cooperation and symbiotic merger that invites a very different set of cultural values and which might inform a very different system of economics and technology. The competition-based Darwinist paradigm not only drew support from its cultural milieu, but reinforced it as well. It seemed to offer a justification for the terrible social inequalities that existed between rich and poor, as well as for the relationship between the, quote, races of man. The rich and powerful were more fit, and therefore deserved to thrive, while the poor, bless their souls, were less fit, and their demise nothing more than the course of nature. Liberals and conservatives agreed on this fundamental premise, even as they disagreed on what to do about it. Liberals lamented the plight of these inferior people and races, and sought to soften the blow, arguing that man could rise above nature, red in tooth and claw. Conservatives, on the other hand, believed this genetic triage to be a good thing. Some even went so far as to oppose any sort of government intervention to bring better conditions to the poor on the grounds that it would weaken the gene pool, allowing the less fit to survive. Such thinking, taken to a further extreme, led to the movement in the United States, coordinated in Cold Spring Harbor, New York, to purposefully strengthen the gene pool through the forced sterilization of, quote, inferior people, such as mental patients and prisoners. In Germany, of course, this science of eugenics helped motivate the Holocaust. This is one way the principle of reductionism can lead to the program of engineering and control, and quite literally reduces life. For the eugenicists of Cold Spring Harbor and Nazi Germany, here was finally a, quote, scientific basis for the ultimate engineering project, the improvement of the human race. The rationalistic garb of the Nazi program was more than just a cloak for barbarism. It was basic to the whole enterprise of eugenics. Moreover, the distancing of the researcher from the object of study that defines objective scientific inquiry also contributed to the dehumanization of their victims. Naturally, then, bland technocrats such as Adolf Eichmann played key roles in orchestrating the logistics of the Holocaust, which, when reduced to the language of the factory, inputs, outputs, job specializations, and budgets, is cognitively no different from any other engineering problem. I do not mean to lay the blame for social Darwinism, and certainly not for ethnic cleansing, at the feet of humble, humane Charles Darwin, although hints of these ideas may be found in his writing, but rather to illustrate that scientific theories do not exist in isolation from their social environment. Darwinism was born in an environment conducive to its acceptance, and its concepts, in turn, reinforced and accelerated pre-existing trends. Darwinism was both the cause and an effect of ideas like competition is good, competition is the way of nature, and competition is the engine of progress. Equally and on a deeper level, Darwinism was a consequence of the millennia of separation that preceded it, as well as a major impetus accelerating that separation to its present climax. Darwinism constitutes a necessary scientific apparatus for the projection of our defining ideology, the discrete and separate self, onto biology. The primary competition in nature and human nature dovetails closely with the ideology of the discrete self living in an objective universe. Life as a competition for resource necessitates that there be competitors, discrete subjects whose conflicting interests drive the constant struggle for survival. It also implies a distinction between life and resources that translates in our perceptions to a distinction between self and world. These interdependencies ensure that as long as the age of separation holds sway over our thoughts, the neo-Darwinian synthesis will reign as orthodoxy, no matter what practical difficulties it encounters. Indeed, current attempts to explain the emergence of the first replicator have run into severe, probably insuperable difficulties, which theorists explain away along the lines of, something like this must have happened, there is no other way. Analogues to these difficulties plague the entire story of evolution based on random mutation and natural selection. The principal difficulty is what various writers have termed the bootstrap problem, or irreducible complexity. I will examine irreducible complexity in detail in Chapter 6, because the nature of the problem points conspicuously to the different conception of self that I have hinted at throughout this book. Whether in Darwin's time or today, the standard theory of life's origin and evolution owes its acceptance more to its integration into our overall conception of self and world than to its scientific merits. Note to the scientific reader, if you still suspect I have an agenda of intelligent design, you haven't been reading very carefully. From my perspective, mechanism and intelligent design are opposed only superficially. Both imply that any spirit must come from the outside. They disagree only on whether such an outside spirit, intelligence, or organizing principle exists. The alternative I offer builds on substantial groundwork that I develop in Chapter 6, but here is a preview. I offer the reader not a mundane universe in which nothing is sacred because there is no God, nor a split universe in which some things are wholly of God and others just matter, but rather a universe that is fully sacred, pregnant with meaning, immanent with God, in which order, pattern, and beauty arise spontaneously from the ground up, neither imposed from above by a designer, nor projected from within by the observer, and of which God is an inseparable property. The marvelous complexity and beauty of nature is not some consolation prize for science's denial of the sacred, but evidence that the universe is itself sacred. Such a shift in worldview, of course, carries profound implications for the way we live. Conventionally, technology has been seen as a logical extension of natural evolution, an acceleration of the biological imperative to outcompete other life forms and extract more energy from the environment. The history of technology seems to bear this out, as it has allowed us to usurp enough of the Earth's solar income and biomass to support 6 billion humans today, as compared to a few million in the Stone Age. It is, however, becoming increasingly apparent that our present way of life and relationship to the planet is not sustainable. As we saw in Chapter 1, the technological program is failing. Perhaps a new understanding of life's evolution based on symbiosis, interconnectedness, and emergent order will inspire a new mode of technology as well, that does not put us into opposition to the rest of life, that does not separate us from nature, and that does not consign us to the misery, alienation, loneliness, and powerlessness that has resulted from the specialization and mass scale of life that technology has brought. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Alone in the universe. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Shakespeare's Macbeth. However distasteful the dispirited world of deterministic forces acting on objective particles, however dispiriting a biology, an economy, and a psychology rooted in the struggle to survive, for several hundred years now, it would seem that we have no viable alternative to believe in. Whatever religion teaches or intuition suggests, science has told us, sorry, the world is just like that. Remember Richard Dawkins, quote, "The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference," close quote. In other words, it has been the sober view of science that no matter what meaning or purpose we impute to the world, all that is really happening is fundamental particles interacting according to impersonal, objective, deterministic laws. There may be other higher-level contingent explanations for things, but the most fundamental explanation, the real reason for anything, even love, boils down to particle A bumps into particle B. It was the genius of Darwin to explain how complex life could develop from a foundation of deterministic material laws, collapsing the last stronghold of religion. Thanks to random mutation and natural selection, with the addition of subsequent developments in genetics and biochemistry, no longer was any kind of animating force necessary to explain life. Chance alone was the only reason why human beings, or indeed any life, arose on the planet. As Jacques Monod puts it in Chance and Necessity, the universe was not pregnant with life, nor the biosphere with man. Our number came up in the Monte Carlo game. Close quote. We are alone in the universe, in which the only meaning is that which we create. Elsewhere in the book, Monod quite astutely defines the source of morality, values, and ethics in animism, the belief that nothing is truly inanimate, but that all things are infused with spirit and purpose. Yet science, the fruit of objectivity, a new and unique source of truth, utterly confounds animism. The vestiges of animism in modern thought he sees as a pusillanimous refusal to face up to the truth. We accept the power and gifts science has brought us, but our refusal to accept its full philosophical consequences leaves us living a lie. Speaking of scientific objectivity, Monod writes, "If we accept this message, accept all it contains, then man must at last wake out of his millenary dream, and in doing so wake to his total solitude, his fundamental isolation. Now does he at last realize that like a gypsy, he lives at the boundaries of an alien world, a world that is deaf to his music, just as indifferent to his hopes as to his suffering or his crimes," close quote. Monod's remonstrance is but a statement of his own unconscious assumptions, assumptions rooted in the Galilean banishment of subjectivity. We live at the boundary of an alien world, yes, but it is we who have defined that boundary into existence. Science, at its very foundation, defines the world as alien. Once we have bought into that definition and accepted it as an unquestionable axiom, extremes of separation, alienation, and despair follow as a matter of course. Fully immersed in the ideology of science, Bertrand Russell, for one, could see no way out. Quote, "Even more purposelessness, more void of meaning, is the world which science presents for our belief. Amid such a world, if anywhere, our ideals henceforward must find a home. That man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his fears, his loves, and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and the whole temper of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built." Close quote. At least Russell was forthright about it. It has been far more common to obfuscate these truths and to mute that unyielding despair. Russell's logic is impeccable. His conclusions follow inexorably from the mythology of science that immersed him and still immerses us. The distractions and addictions that mute the despair, the frenetic pace and empty acquisitiveness of modern society, point to an inner vacuity, the end result of the progressive extirpation of subjectivity. While we associate Russell's sentiments with the pinnacle of classical science in the turn of the 20th century, these were merely the finale of a process that began long ago, when label and number first began to strip the world of particularity. How ironic it is that the end point of this vast campaign to make the world ours was to exclude ourselves from the world entirely. The human realm has expanded to encompass all reality, yet we are alone in the universe. A key theme that will emerge later in this book is that this aloneness is an illusion, an artifact of our self-definition, a byproduct of our way of relating to the world. In your heart of hearts, you know this. Even if your intellectual opinion is the same as Manal's or Dawkins, your behavior betrays you. Beliefs are not just ideas in our heads. They are not just opinions, but reveal themselves as actions. All of us, even the most cynically ruthless, act from time to time as if life were not, in Shakespeare's words, a sound and a fury signifying nothing. We might profess to believe in the complete indifference of the universe. We might profess to believe that the events of our lives are mostly random, that there is no purpose to our existence, that we are indeed as helpless as a Newtonian mass to alter our fate, except to master a greater force than the forces buffeting us. And the structures of our society conspire to reinforce that belief. But none of us actually believes it. I know, because we don't act that way. Manot is right. We are still animists at heart. What the knower in our hearts knows is that the people and events of our lives are connected according to an ineffable logic, proceeding as if by divine orchestration toward a destiny that flows from who we are and changes according to who we choose to be. Not just some events, but all events are significant. None are random. Yes, I am asserting the magical thinking shared by all primitive cultures. Science disagrees. Science says we merely project non-existent patterns and relationships onto a random reality. Let me return to a statement I made earlier in this chapter. By this logic, the other objects of the universe, including living ones, do not really matter. They lack something that the self possesses. Morality applies to them no more than it applies to a blender, a clock, close quote. But maybe morality does apply to blenders and clocks. Maybe they are no more insensate brutes than plants, animals, or people. Science understands the affection we have for inanimate objects to be a jejune projection of human qualities onto things. Have you ever felt sorry for an old car you finally sent to the junkyard, an old baseball mitt, a doll? Our childish minds tend to impute human feelings to them, even though they are actually just composed of lifeless, unconscious matter. It is this childishness that Monod rails against, echoed by a chorus of voices calling for higher scientific literacy, a more technocratic society. Let's put the experts in charge. As individuals, let's grow up. Be reasonable. Be dispassionate. Be rational. Your car is just a hunk of metal. Your baseball mitt is just a piece of leather. Well, this book says otherwise. I say your affections are sourced in valid intuition rather than puerile fantasy. I align myself with the intuitions of children and primitive who ascribe consciousness and spirit to all things of the universe, animate or not. The Native American term, all my relations, is not limited to living beings. It includes mountains, rocks, waterfalls, lakes, the wind, the soil. All have spirit, perhaps even life. The error would come in not applying morality to inanimate objects, but in applying the same morality to them as we do to living beings. Being good to your car does not mean covering it with a blanket on cold nights. Today, we commit an error far worse than that. Cut off from our animistic love of the material world, our treatment of it is devoid of affection, devoid of love, devoid of morality. Cut off from animism, we wreck the world with moral impunity. I will not offer proof that animism is true. As you will discover if you try to apply it to your love life, the whole quest for certainty can invalidate even the possibility of what it is trying to establish. No, you can never be sure that your car, baseball mitt, doll, or for that matter, pet, friend, or lover really has subjectivity. In the end, belief comes down to a choice. Unfortunately, our choice for several hundred years has been colored by an emptying ideology that has now become obsolete. No longer need divine orchestration depend on a divine orchestrator imposing his design upon the world. No longer need consciousness or spirit be infused from without, a ghost inhabiting a machine. Drawing on newly emerging paradigms in science, an alternative far more magnificent than that is now available. With a sad sigh, we turn away from our heart's knowing and live a life under control, applying a personalized version of the technological program to ourselves. The nature that we conquer includes human nature. We do so out of fear. We are scared out of living according to our knowledge of a purpose, significance, and sacredness to each act, event, person, place, and thing. In a million ways, culture conditions us to accept all the premises of separation. Deep down, we know it isn't true, but we are afraid that it is. We are afraid that there is just this, just a bunch of discrete, separate beings, in a blind, pitiless, and indifferent universe of force and mass. Impelled by both the fear and the inner knowing, people have tried for several centuries to find a way out of the seemingly unbreakable stranglehold of deterministic science. Often their efforts amount to the naive bravado of science can never explain everything. But as one mystery after another succumbs to scientific explanation, the bravado sounds increasingly desperate, and the dread grows that maybe science can explain everything. Maybe the scientific program can be fulfilled. Take heart, skeptics. I do not intend these pages to trot out unexplained mysteries and deduce from them that, see, there is room left for God after all? Such an approach actually subtly reinforces the Cartesian worldview. It posits two realms, one which encompasses vast swaths of solved mysteries, almost everything, in fact, that is material, blind, pitiless, and indifferent, and the other that is spiritual, but increasingly inconsequential, as one new mystery after another succumbs to scientific explanation. No, the truth is far more splendid than an indifferent material universe run by a creator god, or a disappearing mote of spirit inside a robot made of flesh. That is not to deny that there are still unexplained mysteries, just that we need not rely upon them as a source of sacredness and meaning. In fact, the new humanist implication, echoing the ideology of the scientific program, that most of the mysteries have been solved is laughable. What has happened is that the scientific establishment has excluded vast areas of reality from consideration simply because the phenomena do not fit into current paradigms. I am reminded of Richard Feynman's reaction to Uri Geller's demonstration of spoon bending. I'm smart enough to know I'm stupid. By that he means that there must be some sleight of hand trick involved, some stage magic that an uninitiated observer, even a brilliant physicist, could not detect, because it couldn't have been real. To Feynman, that was a possibility not even worth investigating. And so it goes for the vast realm of, quote, anomalies, PSI, precognition, homeopathy, Qigong, and others, which are excluded from the realm of the mysterious on dogmatic grounds. The logic is circular. There must be a mundane explanation, fraud, delusion, sloppy science, or overlooked physical mechanisms, because we can account for everything. Notice here again the trap of language. The word mundane simultaneously means of the world and unremarkable. Something mundane is not magical, mysterious, sacred, or amazing. By using the word, we imply that the world itself lacks those qualities. We imply that the world is not an ongoing, living miracle. Starting with Fritjof Capra's seminal The Tao of Physics and Ilya Prigogine's Order Out of Chaos, various thinkers have testified to a sea change in the fundamental underpinnings of science, a shift away from the Newtonian world machine. Awareness is growing that 20th century science has obliterated the Newtonian principles of determinism, reductionism, objectivity, dualism, and mechanism. We are now just beginning to experience the effects of this shift, which implies nothing less than a crumbling of certainty, the death knell of the scientific program, and the end of the regime of separation. No longer need we appeal to bravado or intuition to deny it. Science itself has developed to the point where its own assumptions have become transparently untenable. The same has happened to the illusion of separation generally. All lies tend to grow, even to colonize all of life for their maintenance, but in doing so become all the more fragile and all the more transparent. We have invested deeply in ours, but the game is up. The energy required to maintain the lie of the discrete and separate self far outweighs the benefits. We are beginning to let go. In Chapter 6, I will describe how the second scientific revolution that is now underway implies a very different conception of self and world, one that will inevitably undo the regime of control, the ambitions of the technological program, the conversion of life into money, the Steinerian war of all against all, and the other bitter fruits of the age of separation. Whether held by the rational atheist or the religious fundamentalist, the belief that the material world is not in itself sacred has some devastating consequences. Internally, they are the existential void, the cosmic alienation, the unyielding despair upon which we must attempt to build a philosophy of life. And externally, we mirror this internal wasteland with a corresponding campaign of destruction that treats the earth and everything on it as nothing more than inconsequential lumps of matter. What else could we expect, having defined it thus? The only limit to our despoilation of reality is a vestigial compunction, the remnant of our innate love of life. Well-meaning people seek to rationalize it along the lines of, we should protect the environment because we depend on it. However, since the technological program implies that this dependence is temporary and diminishing, such a rationale is rarely compelling and indeed contributes to the underlying ideology that values nature only for its practical usefulness to man. What other conclusion could there be in the absence of the sacred? How much of humanity's depredation, violence, and ruination arises from the cosmic alienation implicit in the mechanical universe? It is a universe in which, in Jacques Monod's words, man knows at last that he is alone in the universe's unfeeling immensity, out of which he emerged only by chance. His destiny is nowhere spelled out, nor his duty. Close quote. He could have gone on, as Russell does, in A Freeman's Worship, to say that destiny and duty, and therefore goodness, morality, and purpose, are for us to create ourselves. Ultimately, then, they are artificial. The artificiality, or culturally constructed nature of meaning, is a cornerstone of the deconstructionism that so influenced 20th century thinking about literature and art. Deconstructionism attempts to grapple with the nihilistic void I have described above, and once served a useful purpose in its critique of the reductionistic quest for objective certainty. But eventually it foundered on its own premises or lack thereof, degenerating into an irrelevant corpus of sterile, opaque, frivolous, and often silly texts. Or maybe it's just that I feel stupid whenever I try to read them. Texts and texts about texts and texts about texts about texts, another artificial realm mirroring the one we find ourselves in generally. This book is not just another version of postmodernism that says reality only comes into being through our interpretation of it. All of those qualities that elude reductionism, purpose, meaning, order, beauty, sacredness, emerge organically as a function of the relatedness with or without human participation. The deconstructionists and the postmodernists are the most recent incarnation of a long line of cultural sensitives, Heidegger and Nietzsche, Sartre and Camus, Foucault and Derrida, who sought to come to terms with our separation from the matrix of organic divinity and keep nihilism at bay. But none of them truly rejected the premises of that separation. Nihilism, existentialism, deconstructionism are all different expressions of Russell's unyielding despair. The glittering promise of the new worlds of the Enlightenment hid that despair for a while. In the 20th century, as the failure of that promise grew increasingly undeniable, the despair, too, reared its ugly head. In the present day, our final escape has been apathy, cynicism, and resignation, camp and kitsch, whatever, I don't care, and I don't care that I don't care. Or devotion to the acknowledgedly unimportant and absurd. Sports teams, reality TV, game shows, soap operas, trivia. Separated completely from the real world, we content ourselves with its most inane counterfeit. Except, of course, we are not content. The pleasures our escapes offer can barely assuage the pain of the interior wound, even in the best of times. All the more feeble they are revealed to be when the crises of real life find a way in. It is then that the pathetic illusoriness of the manufactured realm becomes apparent. Exposure to passion, heartbreak, loss, pain, illness, and death brings us back to a realm that, despite the ideology that so completely possesses us, is undeniably, experientially real. When this happens collectively, as it will with the impending convergence of crises, we will look back upon our former preoccupations, the Super Bowls and the celebrities, with jaws agape. What world were we living in? How could we have cared so much about so little? In a world in which nothing matters, the most atrocious events are no longer horrifying, The most piteous victims no longer stir our compassion. The most frightening possibilities, like nuclear war and ecological destruction, no longer frighten us. Sometimes we explain it away as compassion fatigue, but really it is a disconnection from reality. None of it seems real. We sit back benumbed, watching the world slide slowly toward a precipice as if it were an on-screen enactment. Similarly, we watch the years of our own lives march on, indifferent to the preciousness of each passing moment. Only once in a while an alarm goes off. We panic for a moment with a thought like, "This is real. This is my life. What am I here for?" And then our environment tempts us back into stupor. This sense of unreality facilitates the unrecognized flip side to nihilism, a corresponding license to unlimited dominion over the universe. There is no purpose to fulfill, no natural role or function, nothing aside from superstition and the temporary practical limitations to prevent us from becoming indeed the lords and possessors of nature. The will to dominate nature mirrors our self-imposed exile from nature. The more we dominate, own, and control, the more separate we experience ourselves. The more separate we experience ourselves, the greater the urge to dominate, to own, to control. We are attempting to take by force that which is already ours. Like the affluence of the hunter-gatherer, what we desire most has always been available without much effort. The compulsion to add more and more to the self arises from our denial of all that we are. How do I know this? How do I know this, that we are more? I know it in the same way you do. Certain moments have shown me. They came unbidden and without effort or contrivance. Although a semi-conscious shift is underway, we as a species have still not quite experienced the furthest extreme of separation that will mark the Capraean turning point toward an age of reunion. We are almost there, though. Once so wholly embedded within nature that we could not even conceive of it as something separate from ourselves, we now possess an ideology that allows no other conclusion but our complete alienation. In our age, the consequences of our pretense to dominion over life and the world have borne full flower, a world in which our ambition to become the lords of nature manifests itself as a totalizing program of control, and in which our ambition to become nature's possessors manifests itself as a totalizing regime of money and property. These two trends go back thousands of years. Finally now, the reduction of reality into representation described in Chapter 2 is approaching its ultimate expression in the conversion of life, time, and the world into money, while the technological program of control is culminating in the effort to bring all aspects of human existence into its domain. The next two chapters will explore these, the consummating expressions of the age of separation. And that is the conclusion of Chapter 3, The Way of the World, from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises, that is, Birthing the Transition, by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. We'll continue next week with more. But if you cannot bear to wait, you can read this book online, because he gives it as a gift at ascentofhumanity.com. And you can download a copy of this program as an MP3, as well as all previous episodes, also as a gift, online at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. They'll take the money.